One in five Australians live with a mental health condition. That's more than 4 million people. But despite it being one of the most common health issues impacting our community, we still find it difficult to talk about. I'm one of those one in five people, and I think it's time we change society's perception of mental illness and how we view those who live with it. Because guess what? We're people like you.
This podcast is brought to you by Sane Stigma Watch in partnership with Mindframe, an Every Mind program. The stories shared on this podcast may be tough to hear. They may hit home a little closely, or you might simply empathise strongly with one of our guests' experiences. Take care when listening, and if you need extra support, visit our website, sane.org.
Hi, I'm Cam Solnadell. I'm a patron with Sane, and I've lived with the diagnosis of schizophrenia for over 20 years. Welcome to the third episode of We're People Like You. I begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. We also recognise that lived experience lives here. Sane respects and champions the individual and collective expertise of people with a lived experience of mental health issues and their families and communities, and people impacted by suicide. We recognise their vital contribution at all levels and value the courage of those who share this unique perspective for the purpose of learning and growing together to achieve better outcomes for all. So in today's episode, I'm excited to welcome journalist and author of The One Thing We've Never Spoken About, a book about her lived experience of her mother's complex mental health condition, Sane Ambassador Elfie Scott. Elfie's multifaceted career has seen her captivate audiences as a host, engage readers with thoughtful writing, and inspire meaningful conversations through personal storytelling. So glad to have a chat with you today, Elfie.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much for having me, Cam. And also thank you for saying that my work is captivating. That is incredibly generous.
How's your week been?
It's been good. It's relentlessly hot and sweaty here in Sydney, but I'm pushing through.
How long has it taken you to get to good?
So I would say that I am generally quite a naturally optimistic person. I'm a bit of a muppet. I sort of see the world through rose-tinted glasses quite a lot. I would say that I am just generally doing okay. And I've got a pretty sunny disposition, I think, because I never remember anything that I've got the worst long-term memory in the world. I never remember anything that's happened to me. So I think that that sort of sets me up to live in the present quite a lot.
Excellent. So you just, again, this and, oh, look, a kitty, you know. So
Yeah, perfect.
Awesome. Look, you've said previously that you wrote your book as a result of how alone you felt in your family's journey with complex mental health for a long time. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? What was known about mental illness and schizophrenia when Elfie was a kid?
Yeah, really essentially nothing. As I outline in the book, I actually never even heard the word schizophrenia until I was about 14 years old, even though, you know, I'd grown up in this household with schizophrenia, with my mum experiencing auditory hallucinations quite regularly. And so I had this weird kind of, disjointed experience of understanding complex mental health conditions where, you know, I saw my mum experiencing schizophrenia. And I came to learn that that was the diagnosis. But the way that I was exposed to schizophrenia, say, in popular culture or through conversations with friends was as this, you know, horrific beast that you just couldn't understand and, you know, made people irreparably sick. And so the education that I got around schizophrenia and other complex mental health conditions was scarce, if there was any. But everything that I came to know about it was really just from self-education a bit later down the line when I entered university in those later years.
So even in your sort of early to mid-teens, you didn't know what it was?
Absolutely not. No concept of it.
And so what does that look like on a day-to-day schedule with your family and your mum? Like you would have just general unconscious interactions with your family. And I'm sure it was probably, not to put a lien on it, fairly harmless. What was that general life growing up with your mother? What did that look like?
So, you know, my mum is, for very much want of a better term, like high functioning with schizophrenia. And I know that we don't like to use that term anymore, so I very much put that in quotation marks. You know, she was working full time when I was a child. She did all the normal things that mums did. But there was just this part of our lives where she would say, talk to voices that weren't there. She would swear at people that weren't there and shout at them and tell them to stop talking to her. She would, you know, go down the back garden and try to find the source of these voices. There were lots of sort of strange experiences that I had as a kid that we never openly discussed as a family. And so I think it came to occupy this realm in very much the same way that other secrets in families come to occupy that realm. You know, I think a lot of families have open secrets. And so it was just this kind of like lonely, alienating part of my childhood that was never really properly addressed.
Okay. And when it started to become addressed in relation to your relationship with your mother, how did your mother change with it? How did she change with more information about it?
Well, so mum had always been accessing care privately. So I think that she herself had quite a bit of understanding about the diagnosis. It's just that she didn't divulge that information with us. And so she came from a place where, you know, she had a psychiatrist for years and years and spoke to them about what she was experiencing. But we were sort of cut off from that part of her life. And that was actually up until probably in my mid-20s, I think, that my mum just didn't speak about that part of her life to us. But, you know, in recent years, we have kind of broken through that. And there's been a lot of, I guess, a lot of work that's gone into talking to mum and being open with her. And from her perspective as well, there's been a lot of work where she's, you know, told us her story. She's given us more understanding of what she went through when we were kids. So yeah, it's been a process. It's not 100% there yet, I wouldn't say, but yeah, it's definitely evolved over time.
In your book, you touched on the idea that moving was a sort of a bit of a trigger for her trauma. Can you sort of expand on that? Has she talked about that? And like, what did you experience in relation to you sort of growing up in that environment?
Yeah, sure. So this is something that I did a bit of research into when I was writing the book. But, you know, there are these concepts that are very much backed up by the evidence that people who are transplanted from the cultures and backgrounds where they feel most comfortable, where they feel they identify, can be very traumatic. And, you know, my mum had lived all around the world, but she said she always really resented the idea of moving to Australia. So I think that moving here in particular was really difficult for her. And certainly what I observed when I was a kid was that, you know, we were one of the, if not the only kind of Asian family in our suburb. You know, when we were growing up, we were very much surrounded by families who wouldn't be explicitly racist and weren't discriminating against us, but certainly just couldn't relate to us and the kind of different culture that my mum brought. So it was always this kind of outsider's perspective. And I think that in writing the book, I came to recognize more and more that that was a very isolating experience, both for my mum and for my family in some ways, and that there are these inherent pieces of culture that can really intersect with the way that we experience mental health.
Yeah. How was your dad's relationship with that?
I mean, my dad is he's a bit more nerdy. He's a bit more insular. So I don't think that these are things that he necessarily like thinks about, because he's very much stuck in like academia and reading books and, you know, being that kind of person. So I think it's hard to broach those kind of topics with him. But, you know, I think that he's lived in a lot of different places and he's extremely open-minded about hearing about those kind of issues.
Yeah, fair enough. As we approach the mid-2020s, and as a journalist for you, what signs or sort of emerging trends in media and reporting are you starting to pick up on that look like that they will become the next unhealthy parts of the media to engage in for consumers, specifically with mental health, but also around that area? What do you think that we need to be more careful of in the next couple of years?
I mean, I think that I feel apprehensive to be critical of trends in media, as I am a participant in media, but there are things that I find a bit troubling, and I don't necessarily think they're unhealthy. I think that some people can engage with these topics in quite a healthy way, but I think that there are a lot of topics at the moment that are very much centered around individualistic notions of wellness. And while I applaud that in the sense that I think that everybody needs to think carefully about self-care and these kind of things, I would encourage audiences to read those articles with a grain of salt, because, you know, I think it's very easy to say that, you know, you should be doing self-care, you should be doing yoga, you should be using these beauty products. Like, a lot of that journalism is being used to sell products and to engage with broader trends, sort of capitalist trends, I suppose. So I'm very wary when I see these kind of wellness articles, and it's been happening for a long time, obviously. Like, wellness doesn't come out of nowhere, but I think that those kind of continuing trends of talking about individualistic wellness rather than broader systemic issues and how we can support one another, that always grinds my gears.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Very interesting. Do you think that it's affecting kids these days?
Look, I think that kids, I feel a lot of optimism about the next generation, because whenever I do speak to Gen Z people who work in journalism and things like that, they are very discerning about the way that the internet and social media are impacting their mental health, and they try to step away from it probably more than us millennials were ever taught to. So I'm reticent to say that in particular is affecting kids, because I am not one to talk, basically.
That's fascinating. What sort of compartmentalization are they able to give to that? How have they, you know, learnt from, you know, millennials and you know, Gen X who built it, sort of thing? How have they managed to stop using that kind of thing?
Well, I don't know if this is like a very broad trend, but I have noticed that a lot of the Gen Z people who I speak to are, say, stepping away from social media. They bar themselves from being on their profiles for like really extended periods of time. They've deleted Instagrams and Facebooks and things like that. So I think that there is, at least among a certain group of people that I've spoken to, a certain rebellion against those kind of systems. But you know what? I also recognize that a lot of the newspaper articles that I read about it tell me that, you know, kids are experiencing incredible rates of cyberbullying, and they feel a huge amount of loneliness and isolation online too. So maybe this is only a certain subset of people, but I hope that we can all try and compartmentalize those parts of our lives, because at the end of the day, they're not healthy for anybody.
How do you think that kids could talk about not just general mental health, but more complex mental health, especially with what you were talking about, a stronger way to compartmentalize and disassociate with these unhealthy behaviors? Once a diagnosis is made, how do you think kids can find a stronger connection with talking about something like complex mental health that could help themselves, help their peers, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of online resources that I came to get to grips with when I was researching the book. Obviously, SANE's mental health forums are a fantastic resource because they're moderated and there are people with professional psychology backgrounds there to help moderate those communities and to, you know, step in whenever needed. But I would also say that there are some like pretty incredible online communities that exist outside of mental health organizations. Like, even on Reddit, I found some remarkably supportive places where people could speak to one another and really, yeah, engage with broader issues to do with complex mental health. So yeah, I think that those communities absolutely exist, and a few of them absolutely flourishing as far as I can tell. I would also say that, you know, there is a lot to be said for activism and engaging in politics as a means of not allowing yourself to feel sort of oppressed and depressed as well. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of kids out there who are now engaging on quite high levels of political activism because they see issues in the world around them. I think that climate change is a great example of this. You know, all of these youth-led organizations that are calling for climate action. But I also see these fantastic mental health advocates online, these really young kids who are seeing systemic issues, who are saying, you know, that's not right and that needs to change. And they're just going for it. And I think that that is another fantastic route for anybody who's feeling really challenged by the issues that they're seeing in the world around them.
It's so much easier today to make available the tools to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I think there are so many impressive kids out there. If I had had those kind of role models when I was younger, I think I would have been doing a lot more with my teenage years. But I think the kids today, the world is scary and the future is scary in many ways, but I think that they're doing a fantastic job of trying to bottle that angst and use it for real gains and to make the world a better place.
If you could put a change in tomorrow, what would you do?
Any change?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I mean, I'm a very science nerdy person. I'm a climate obsessed person. So my change would be very much to do with overhauling energy systems. If I could change every energy system in the world tomorrow to be a renewable power source, that's what I would do.
Yeah, we need far less carbon dioxide in our lungs to be quite simple.
Yeah, that would be great.
Elfie, thank you so much. Look, just to circle back, how's the rest of your week looking?
Oh, how is the rest of my week looking? It's looking free. It's looking hot as well, which is good because I live about 15 minutes walk from the beach, so I'm going to be swimming a lot. And I've got a book that I need to finish that's like 500 pages long, and I've just been slogging through it, so I'm going to get to the end of that.
Marvelous. Elfie, thank you so much for your chat today.
Thank you so much for that, Cam. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Don't miss new episodes as they drop over the coming weeks. Subscribe to the Where People Like You pod on all the usual channels. Share episodes you find interesting with your family, friends, and colleagues on social media, tagging SANE. Where People Like You.